there's a condition called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. It's a Japanese name, where it's basically broken heart syndrome. A lot of people who have, for example, lost a loved one or dealing with grief, they actually go into acute heart failure.
Welcome to Ditch the Lab Coat with Dr. Mark Bonta, a podcast that examines health issues with a critical eye grounded in scientific skepticism.
Disclaimer. The Ditch the Lab Coat podcast is exclusively meant for general informational purposes and should not be regarded as a substitute for professional medical services, including medicine or nursing. It does not create a doctor-patient relationship, and any reliance on the information provided in the podcast or linked materials is at the user's own risk. The content is not intended to replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The expressed opinions belong solely to the host and guests, and they do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the hospitals, clinics, universities, or any other organization associated with the host or guests. Welcome, everybody. Today, we have a great episode. Now, in my clinical existence as a specialist in general internal medicine, I care for a lot of patients who are having problems with their hearts. Whether it's heart attacks, heart failure, or heart rhythm problems, I'm having this conversation time and time again with my patients, whereby I outline the fact that the heart is simply a muscle that pumps. And to do so, it needs good plumbing. So it needs good supply of oxygen from the blood vessels, and it needs good electrical conduction or electricity. And so we often get into this analogy of plumbing and electrical work when we're describing issues that patients are having with their heart. Today in the studio, I have a plumber, an interventional cardiologist. Now, Dr. Michael Ward joins us today, and he's an interventional cardiologist who works in London, Ontario at London Health Sciences Center. As an interventional cardiologist, he sees patients who are having a heart attack and helps to unblock the arteries in their hearts. He also helps people prevent this from occurring and helps people recover from it as well. He serves as an assistant professor at Western University in London, Ontario, and teaches at the Schulich School of Medicine and Dentistry. He's a double doctorate. He has an MD and a PhD, both of which he received at the University of Toronto, and pursued his medical training in Toronto as well, prior to moving to London in 2019. Outside of plumbing and working on coronary arteries, he is heavily involved with a genetic condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is a condition that makes the heart very thick and less able to pump blood as well. He works with families who have this genetic predisposition and treats the condition with medications and interventional procedures. One thing that he wants all of you to know is that there's a common misconception about his area, which is that cardiologists are intense and unapproachable people. Most of them are very kind and very patient, and he is definitely one of those. I've known him for close to 20 years, and he is one of the most well-spoken, caring, and compassionate clinicians that I know, and it's a pleasure to have him in the studio today. In today's discussion, we hear about Dr. Michael Ward's take of the comments that I make about the heart being a muscle and the whole plumbing and electrician analogies that I use to describe things. And he really gets into explaining what's happening at a cellular level, what it feels like to get an angiogram, what to make sense of in the news headlines out there, red wine, chocolate, diet, exercise. What really works to promote a good and healthy heart? Not only does Dr. Michael Ward talk the talk, but he also likes to walk the walk and describes his life as being very balanced, spending a lot of time with his partner, Elaine, getting out to exercise a few times a week, engaging in the community around him. And he strongly believes in the importance of vacations, and he tries to get away every few months for the value of his mental health, which is certainly related to cardiac health. And he will describe that and get into it today in today's session. So with that being said, let's dive into the studio and let's get into conversation with Dr. Michael Ward, interventional cardiologist. So really excited to have you in the studio today, Dr. Michael Ward, an interventional cardiologist, or should I say a double doctor? You're a double doctor?
That's right, Mark. I do have an MD and a PhD.
Okay, so you're two. So a doctor of philosophy and a medical doctor. And is your PhD in a medical field?
Yeah, so I did what's called the MD-PhD program when I was in medical school, where I did both the medical degree and a doctorate. And at the time, I was really interested in gene-based or cell-based gene therapy. And so my PhD was a lab-based kind of basic science PhD in ways of trying to use stem cells and genetically modifying stem cells to regenerate parts of the heart. So I did that with various lab-based tools, but also what we call in vivo models or lab animal models, so rats and pigs, and spent about 5.5 years outside of medical school. As you know, Mark, we started medical school together, and then I took a hiatus from that to do the PhD, and then I joined up another medical school class later on. You know, I was always interested in science, and that's kind of how I got really hooked on to cardiology, because the project was very much based on cardiovascular health.
So that's a lot of school. How many years of school did you do since kindergarten?
I don't know about kindergarten. I mean, whatever that is, 2 plus 13, 15. And then I did 22 years of post-secondary education before I got my job. So, and now I work in London, Ontario. But I mean, the job is great. I mean, a lot of people, I feel, go through different jobs at various stages of their adult life. Whereas, you know, one of the things that we do in medicine is that we train so much and then we finally get a job and the job ends up being kind of the dream job. And so I very much feel that that was the case. When I was 40 years old, I finally got my job. And that was in London, Ontario. To give a perspective, there was only one job like this in Ontario at the time when I was looking for a job. I was very much a Toronto boy and I didn't want to leave Toronto, but, you know, you go for the job. I moved and, you know, my life has changed accordingly. But having said that, you know, things have all worked out very, very well.
And so as an interventional cardiologist, I know people like using different descriptors of the heart being a dumb muscle, and that dumb muscle has nerves and plumbing. What do you think of the heart? Like, do you think the heart's a dumb muscle? Do you think it's a fascinating organ? Like, you've spent a lot of time studying the heart. So when you describe your approach to the heart, how do you describe that to people? And how do you see your job or your role as an interventional cardiologist?
Well, I think there's a lot of levels to that question or those questions. I mean, certainly I don't think any part of the body is dumb. Yes, you know, the heart is the pump, right? It is a pump, but the pump has to respond to all the various demands of the body. And those are, for example, if the body is sick from other causes, lung disease, cancer, what have you, the heart responds. The heart responds to exercise. The heart responds to stress. The heart responds to various other levels of triggers. The heart responds to drugs and drug addictions and so on. And so, you know, the cardiovascular response to many things is what's fascinating and also does kind of indicate whether you're going to tolerate things well or not. And what I mean by that is if your cardiovascular system doesn't tolerate things, that's when your life is really at risk. And so one of the things that really appealed to me in going into cardiology was that really is the foundation of life and death, and really does, you know, if you can modify or improve the way the cardiovascular system works, you really do have a role and a potential at really improving the quality of life and the longevity of people. The heart itself is so intelligent, I think, in that it has, yes, a neurological system, meaning it has nerve fibers that run through it that coordinate how well it pumps and what the timing is of the pumping. And there are multiple abnormalities that, you know, electrophysiology doctors deal with, like arrhythmias, you know, the common ones being atrial fibrillation or ventricular tachycardia that kind of are well known in that sphere. But then also, yeah, it's a pump. And just like any pump, it gets blocked with calcified narrowings, which impair the way blood flows through it. And that's essentially what also causes heart attacks. But also, you know, what's not really well understood, but is actually I see almost every week, is how hormones and stress impact the heart. There's a condition called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. It's a Japanese name where It's basically broken heart syndrome. A lot of people who have, for example, lost a loved one or dealing with grief, they actually go into acute heart failure. And we see them hospitalized as if it was a major heart attack, but actually it's not. It really is stress-induced problem. So I really do see the heart as a central figure in the body, and it's a privilege to work on that. To answer your second question around what does it mean to be an interventional cardiologist, there are various interventions that we do on the heart. There are surgeons that do various jobs on the heart, for example, replacing valves, doing bypass surgery, transplants. I don't do that. I'm not a surgeon, but I do all procedures that are called percutaneous, which is Latin essentially for going through the skin. So we go and we go through the skin and then through arteries and veins to access the heart. So often through the wrist or through the leg, and we go up those arteries and veins up into the heart. And then we do our procedures through catheters that extend our reach, so to speak. And that includes responding to acute heart attacks. So in the middle of the night, sometimes I'm called to go to the hospital and deal with someone who's having a heart attack. And sometimes it's, you know, opening up blockages because people are having angina on a daily basis. They can't take their walks with their dogs like they normally would do. Or sometimes it's even younger people who are used to going skiing and, you know, doing things that are fairly active, but all of a sudden they can't because they're having chest pain or they just don't feel as fit as they used to. So those are the various things that I get to do. You know, I spend my time 2 to 3 days a week in the cath lab, which is the catheterization laboratory where we do these procedures. And that lab actually is one of the unique places in the hospital that's open 24/7 because we do respond to emergencies at night, but we also do routine cases during the day as well. So we have a staff of physicians and nurses and radiation technologists who are available 24/7 to deal with those cases. So it's very dynamic. It's very busy. It's exciting. It's a great place for teams. Even through the pandemic, it was a privilege to work in that atmosphere where all of us got to see each other every day, despite a lot of people being in lockdown because we were an essential service. And so, yeah, anyway, that's kind of a descriptor of my day-to-day life.
So it's interesting because I when I thought about cardiac health, you know, you corrected me and said cardiovascular health. And obviously, it's more than just a dumb pump, right? It's this muscle and this synergy with the nerves telling it what to do, dependent on the blood supply, bringing oxygen to those muscles to beat. And this is influenced by hormones, by external factors, stresses, drugs, etc. But you mentioned cardiovascular health. And so if you're accessing people through their arteries and veins to get into the heart, at what point does the cardiovascular system end? Like, is it just the big arteries or is it all of those blood vessels? So we got tons of veins and arteries in our system. Like, do you see your role as a cardiologist managing not only the pump, but all of the circulation around it, or the pump and the big vessels only? Like, what is the cardiovascular system?
That's a good question. And I don't know if there's really a good definition of what that is, except that I often relate it with my patients like a tree. So when you look at a tree, you've got the tree trunk, and then you've got the major branches after that. And then you've got all the sub branches all the way down to the twigs and the leaves and so on. And so that's essentially what our cardiovascular system is like. You've got the major trunk, you've got the pump, which feeds the trunk, and then the trunk is the aorta. And after that, every little part of your body has subsequently smaller and smaller blood vessels that feed it and also take blood from it. And, you know, they get so small that they're almost impossible to see. In the cath lab, we use x-ray, what we call fluoroscopy. It's a video x-ray, essentially, to look at the vessels of the heart, but also the, you know, the legs, the neck, the arms. Those are, relatively speaking, the large arteries and veins of the body. The small ones, called capillaries or arterioles, are not visible at all by any of these mechanisms, but only through microscopes. But they all comprise the cardiovascular system. And when we think about health modifications and adjustments with medications, for example, those are the things we're actually addressing more. It's not so much the big arteries and veins, but it's the small ones that actually funnel all of the blood. And so if you have narrowings of those arteries and veins, those are the problems. I focus mostly on arteries, but I'm being inclusive to include veins because that's what the cardiovascular system is. But it's more of a supply issue in the arteries. We know that people who have diabetes, high blood pressure that's not well controlled, cholesterol issues that's not well controlled, genetic risk factors, meaning, you know, family history, they tend to develop more blockages in the arteries. And that's a process called atherosclerosis. I still, to this day, after 22 years of post-secondary education, still can't pronounce it very well, but it is essentially a layering of the arteries with plaque. And the plaque is made up of cholesterol and a very inflammatory milieu of, you know, cells and hormones that are not good for you and essentially narrow and limit the way your arteries respond to your demands. And that's what we do. And that's what GPs do. And that's what internal medicine doctors do. And this is what cardiologists do too, at preventing cardiovascular events. Because what we want to avoid is someone coming in with a heart attack or a stroke. And how we do that is preventing the accumulation of that plaque in the arteries. And so most of what we should be doing, Mark, is prevention. But then there's a few people like me who are there just in case something happens later on.
So atherosclerosis is the accumulation of gunk, right? Mm-hmm. And if that gunk accumulates in the arteries that feed the heart, the coronary arteries, those blockages and that gunk in those arteries would give you, like you said, angina. So chest discomfort and tightness. Those arteries, if they got completely blocked, would give the heart attack. So those things, when you think about a person turns gray and is clutching their chest. But is there a difference between the chronic process, like slowly kind of getting your arteries clogged over time to the point where they don't give you oxygen, and the acute? So can you actually have a big heart attack if you have no atherosclerosis? Like, a clot just end up there? And do you see that a lot?
It's a really important question, because a lot of people, after they've had a heart attack, will say to me, "But doctor, I've done everything right. I don't have diabetes. I control my blood pressure. I eat vegan." You know, all the things that you think are good for cardiovascular health, they do, but then they still have a heart attack. So there are two kind of processes that are important to remember. Yes, there's the gradual accumulation of plaque in the arteries. And mostly that is because of what I mentioned before, the cholesterol and hypertension and stuff. But what can often happen is that there's a little bit of a nick that can occur, and we call that plaque rupture. So it requires just a little bit of plaque, not a lot. But when it ruptures inside the artery, it causes a response. So the cells in our blood called platelets are there to heal things. So when you cut yourself, you bleed in the nose or whatever, those platelets stick to areas and form clots to try to prevent bleeding. Well, they do the same thing in the artery when the plaque ruptures. So they see exposed tissue. It's not the external world, but it's still tissue. And they stick to it and they form a plaque. And the plaque is kind of like a snowball effect. If you think about, you know, a snowball out in the winter, you just keep rolling it and rolling, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that plaque forms a big blockage in the artery. So an acute heart attack is actually a plaque rupturing and causing a big thrombus or clot burden that blocks the artery acutely and then causes the heart attack. It's a very different process than just a kind of a gradual process of narrowing.
And we think about people who are shoveling the snow or doing some type of activity, and then they get really sore and they feel the elephant stepping on their chest and they get sweaty and weak. And that's the classic heart attack. And then we actually diagnose that, not with those symptoms, because you could be having a panic attack and look that way. But we do electrocardiograms and we do blood tests. And it's crazy. Electrocardiograms have been around for over 100 years. And that's how we're actually still diagnosing these things. And when those people come into hospital and you use those tools to detect that, how quickly do you need to act? Like, if someone's experiencing that and has a diagnosis of an acute heart attack made, does it matter? Can you give them pills and do your intervention the next day, or is the sooner the better?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's interesting that you mentioned, you know, shoveling snow, because statistically still the highest day for heart attacks is the first major snowfall. in Canada. And what happens is, yeah, there's a strain there. Like, you know, when you push yourself a lot, whether it be at the gym or doing something outside, you're actually raising your blood pressure quite a bit. And that can cause that plaque rupture event, which then leads to that snowball effect and thrombus and clot formation. Basically, at that point, when it blocks the artery, the muscle of the heart is not getting enough blood flow. It's not getting any to that particular area. So at that moment, time is of the essence. So the faster, the better. Now, historically, people would be admitted to the hospital. They'd be given an aspirin and maybe some blood thinners to deal with that blood clot. But nothing was really done interventionally. But over the last 25 years, there's been programs called Code STEMI programs. Now, STEMI is an acronym for ST elevation myocardial infarction, which is exactly what you meant by, you know, diagnosing things by ECG. The ST elevation is something that we diagnose on the ECG, which can be done in the ambulance or even in AEDs, like at home. Sometimes you can put that on, you can actually see the tracing. So there's multiple ways of identifying that. When you see that pattern, the ST elevation myocardial infarction or STEMI, everything gets mobilized. And we have in Ontario and all the provinces in Canada, STEMI protocols where ambulances can bypass hospitals that don't have a cath lab and come straight to the hospital that does. So, for example, what that looks like for me is I could be at home enjoying a lovely dinner and I get a phone call saying, code STEMI patching from the EMS. Literally, the ambulance driver calls me and says, well, we have this 67-year-old woman who woke up from sleep with this chest pain. Her ECG shows this ST elevation. Do you accept this patient? And if so, where do I go? And then, you know, if it is the real deal, sometimes we, you know, they call us and it's not exactly that. And we just say, no, just go to the closest emergency room. But sometimes, you know, most of the time, actually, they're quite accurate. And we say, okay, we'll see you in the cath lab. They come in and as soon as possible. So we all are supposed to be within 20 minutes of the hospital. Those of us who are on call for this, we don't want to reduce the responsivity that we have. The other aspect is if the ambulance or if that patient is more than 2 hours away from the hospital, there's another protocol and check. So they will go to an emergency room and they will use something called thrombolysis or otherwise called clot busting medications, which is basically almost like an enzyme that you inject intravenously that gnaws away and eats away at the clot that was formed. And that allows some blood flow to be reinstituted to the heart. So I guess the decision is really based on distance. If they are far away, they go and they get thrombolysis, or the drug is called TNK. But if they're close enough, they go straight to the cath lab where myself and my team are waiting for them. And then we do an immediate primary procedure. So kind of the quote is time is myocardium, meaning the longer we wait, the more tissue of the heart is dying. So the faster, the better. And you'll see what, you know, if you were to see us during a code STEMI protocol, everyone's running around. There's no time wasted. We bypass all the steps of security and so on in the hospital because the EMS workers will come and say, code STEMI, we're coming in. We're just coming in. So we're very proud that we've instituted those kind of protocols so that we don't waste time.
Is there too long? Like if someone had those symptoms for 4 hours, like, is there a point where you're like, at this point, doing this intervention, going to the cath lab is not going to help you. And so we just need to hope you survive this and put you on pills? Or is there a time window that works for people or not?
It's a good question. I know that for people listening, I don't want anyone to think that they shouldn't come in because it's been too long. If anything, if you have any chest pain or have any concerns around your cardiovascular health and you do have symptoms, you need to call for help as soon as possible. Don't delay. But unfortunately, sometimes people miss, or there are certain things called silent MIs where people are not aware that they're having a heart attack. And sometimes they'll come in and at the 24-hour mark, roughly, that's where if it's blocked for 24 hours, the damage is done. I mean, we can still open up the blockage, but it's very rare that we see a benefit. And in fact, there are good studies that show that if we do open up the blockage at that point, at the 1 to 2 day mark after a heart attack, it's actually more harm than good, because all of a sudden reinstituted blood flow in that area that's starting to heal from the heart attack actually introduces more toxicity. So sometimes if someone comes in a day or two after the heart attack, we won't actually open up the blockage. We kind of accept, okay, well, that was blocked. Now it's about medicines to help the heart heal, to prevent any further events, and supportive care. Supportive care sounds wishy-washy, but what it means is to say there's a lot of things can occur in the context of a heart attack that are potentially more dangerous, like arrhythmias, heart block, which means your heart stops for a few seconds at a time. All those things need to be helped out during that time to prevent, you know, a worse prognosis, a worse recovery than what was already there. But opening the artery, we know, is not beneficial at that point. I guess the take-home message is the earlier the better, the faster the better, less time wasted, the better.
Can people feel that? Like when you go to the cath lab, and so you're putting a needle with a wire into their arteries in their wrists or in their groin, like what does that feel like? Do people talk about it feels squeamish, I can feel you inside me, or do they feel nothing? Like what is the patient experience?
They often come in super nervous because they think it's this big surgery, and then they're told they're going to be awake for the whole thing, which is, you know, blows their mind. And they say, no, put me out, doc. And we say, no, we don't need to. So we don't have nerves in our arteries. The arteries, yes, have a neurological system, but they're basically designed to actually close or open or narrow or dilate. They don't tell your brain that you're in pain. The only thing that does that we actually go through is the skin. So we use topical lidocaine, which is a topical, you know, anesthetic. So we freeze that just like anything. If you cut yourself and you're getting stitches, it's the same drug. So we do that. And after that, people mostly don't feel anything. When we're opening up the blockage, they do sometimes feel the same chest pressure that they did during the heart attack. And that's because in order to open up the blockage, paradoxically, we actually have to close it. We inflate balloons that interrupt blood flow temporarily. So during the balloon inflation, there's no flow and people feel like they have the same heart attack. But as soon as we deflate the balloon, and that's only 10 to 15 seconds later, they start feeling better. So there's temporary discomfort during the procedure, but most people at the end say, well, that was a lot better than I expected. I thought that was going to be really bad, but it's not.
Well, and one thing I've seen, so I work obviously with a lot of cardiologists and I refer people for angiograms. I work in a rural hospital where we're sending people to get this procedure. And one thing I often hear cardiologists say, and I see them do this thing with their hands, which is they're going to open up the vessels. And so they put their hands together and open up. And lay people, and this has actually been studied, believe that when you're having a blockage, and you talked about a clot blocking your heart, but also how atherosclerosis and narrowing can cause multiple blockages. What I hear when I hear someone describe it that way is that you're straight up fixing my plumbing, right? Like you're going into this tube that has a lot of gunk and you're going in with the snake, you know, those things that plumbers use, and you're finding the gunk and you're suctioning it out and you're leaving a pristine tube in there, and then you're replacing a brand new tube inside and everything's tickety-boo. But when I actually look at a cardiac stent, a stent is not a rigid pipe, but it's kind of like a meshwork. And you're putting that into a living system, the coronary artery or the blood vessel. So what's actually happening? If I were to look inside and go into my nanobot mode and watch you do this inside the heart vessel, what's actually happening is a big rigid stent there opening it up and moving the blood flow from 0 to 100 miles an hour? Or is it not as beautiful and as exotic as that? Like what's actually happening when you go in and open up these vessels?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to be able to tell people that I'm fixing everything that's wrong with their arteries and in their heart, but it's true, we don't do that. One of the challenges and one of the things that makes our job stressful is that we don't know what we're dealing with until we get in there. And what I mean by that is we take diagnostic images first. So we inject contrast dye into the arteries and we get a map of the arteries to work with. The dye is radio opaque. So under X-ray cameras, it looks black and it guides and it gives us the internal structure of the artery. So we can see either a really, really healthy, homogeneously clean artery, or we see an artery at the other extreme that's full of blockages and narrowings and full of plaque throughout. And we know there are certain aspects to your health that will more likely cause one or the other. For example, if you're a fitness guru and you know you're running marathons and stuff, you're unlikely to have a ton of blockages in your arteries because it's just not sustainable that way. So if you're eating a vegan diet and you're working out every day and so on, you're probably not going to be developing a lot of that plaque. But if you're a smoker and you have uncontrolled diabetes, you know, some genetic predisposition, you might have a lot of irregularities and plaque in there. And so what we have to make is a decision about how much we fix. And the more and more evidence is coming out of major trials, actually less is good, meaning we fix what is the critical stuff that's blocked. The most important thing is flow. Blood flow to the heart muscle. And so if something is 40% or 30% blocked, that really doesn't concern us. But it's a bit worrisome because it could get worse. And how we prevent that from getting worse is through medicines and lifestyle changes. We don't fix it all with stents. What we do fix is those 70, 80, 90% blockages or 100% blockages in the context of a heart attack that are really impairing blood flow. And you're right, a stent is not exactly, it's not a new artery. It's not providing 100% blood flow. But what it is, I'd like to think of it as an exoskeleton to the artery. Or if you took a roll of chicken wire and created a cylinder out of it, that's what a stent looks like. It's more holes than metal, but it does have a rigidity. And what it does is provide radial strength. So when you inflate it and you deploy it inside the artery, it keeps a skeleton to the artery and prevents the artery from recoiling down and narrowing acutely. Eventually, you know, the cells around that stent grow around it and heal and form a more rigid arterial wall that's less susceptible to narrowing. So we put them selectively in areas that we think will really improve blood flow. We have to be careful where we put them because we don't want to deploy them in areas where there's a lot of bend in the artery or where there's other disease, like other plaque in there. Because if we deploy the stent in too much plaque, it's actually, we know that it will re-narrow. So there's a lot of different criteria that we have to use. Because of that, we have different size stents. We have everything from 2 millimeter diameter to 6 millimeter diameter, and everything from an 8 millimeter length to up to 40. And if we need more than 40 millimeters, we put a stent in a stent, so it forms a long tube. So it's not much different than a plumber, as you described, because we're basically just fixing what we need to fix to provide more flow through that tubular structure using tools. And we can be very inventive at times where we have to, you know, sometimes we do bifurcation stenting where there's a blood vessel that forms into two, that splits into two, and we have to fix both of the branches. So we have to do almost like a Y-shaped stenting. So there's various different techniques. And in fact, there's a whole bifurcation club in Europe that meet every year to talk about different ways of fixing bifurcations. So there's a whole subculture around how to fix these arteries.
How do I get invited to this club?
I'm not even invited to that club. So if I do get invited, I mean, it's in Paris. So if you want to go, we can go together.
I would love that. The plumbing analogy, I find that's the simplest way to translate things to patients. And if you look at the plumbing in my house, if I put grease, you know, the other day I cooked bacon, right? Pancake Tuesday. So cooked some bacon and made it very clear that, guys, we don't put bacon down the sink, right? We have to dispose of this differently. And the reason for that is the grease can clog the pipes. Now, what you said to me is that if I had a plumber come and he put the snake through all my pipes, I would probably want that plumber to take out all the blockages, right? Even if they're 20% or 40%, because he's at my house, he's got this snake in my pipes anyways, and he's already done the house visit and the service fee is there. So I'm like, just take all the clogging out. But what you're saying is that these large studies have identified that as a cardiologist, if you do this intervention and see all these little blockages throughout the heart, and open them up with these balloons and put stents everywhere, even though it might make the blood vessels look nice and more open, that's not going to have a huge difference down the line, right? And medical management is actually going to be something that should reflect the mainstay. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a really great way of describing it. I mean, I think there's a couple points I have on that. The analogy is mostly accurate, except that when we're talking about arteries of the heart, we're talking about a very alive, hormonally stimulated, biologically stimulated tissue, where the plaque in there is not just cholesterol within a metal pipe, but it's in a way intrinsically part of the vessel wall. So we can't just strip it off. You know, you can't just drag a net back and pull it out and, you know, pull out everything and leave a very happy vessel. If you were to do that, you would leave tissue that would clot in 5 minutes and you'd have a major heart attack. So we can't do that. What we have to do is then layer it down in a way that's safer, that is allows the integrity of the vessel to remain the way it is so that blood flow goes past it without having to form a blood clot. But yes, you're exactly right in saying that fixing the artery is often not the solution. What we do is we do it when it's an extreme blockage. But when we see moderate blockage, so 50%, 60% narrowing, we know it's not enough to be really causing a metabolic problem to the heart tissue. So what we recommend is really just medical therapy and rehabilitation therapy. So exercise therapy, weight loss, sugar reduction if you're diabetic, all those things that help modify the amount of plaque that's deposited. We also have some medications that we know are very effective. Some are a bit controversial. I don't know if you're going to be addressing this, Mark, in your podcast, but statins, for example, we know that they're extremely good at reducing cholesterol, but not only that, they're an anti-inflammatory medication for arteries. So we know that they help heal arteries after you've had problems, but they also prevent heart attacks and strokes. Yet they've gotten a real bad rap in the media because of some studies that have shown some exacerbation of dementia in people using them. I think the jury's still out on what is really the impact of that. But the way I say it, and I crudely say it because I work with 50, 60, 70-year-old people who have heart attacks and vascular disease, if you survive heart attacks and strokes to the point that you get dementia, we've done a good job. So I think still preventing heart attacks and strokes with statins is still very effective. That's one of our pieces of the arsenal, but overall lifestyle change and some medications is where we really have a huge impact.
So when you're driving on the road and you see somebody, you know, white knuckling behind their steering wheel in their big truck, a cigarette hanging out of their mouth and a large soft drink or an energy drink in their hand, does that give you angina? Like when you see that, does that give you chest pain? And what like lifestyle interventions, you mentioned a few, which lifestyle interventions specifically, like running 30 minutes a day? Is it walking up the steps every morning? And are those lifestyle interventions going to be about as good as the pills you can prescribe or better than the pills you can prescribe? And is this someone that everyone should do or just people who have narrowing of their heart vessels or atherosclerosis?
Well, I think, you know, when we talk about in medicine, we have primary prevention and we have secondary prevention. And in certain fields, we have tertiary prevention. So in cardiology, primary prevention means we prevent the first onset of cardiovascular problems. And so that's where your healthy lifestyle comes in. That's, you know, where exercise is fundamental. And that for various people means various things. So certainly, you don't have to be running triathlons and marathons to be considered, you know, preventing cardiovascular disease. But having an active physical lifestyle where you're walking, where you are getting your heart rate up on a regular basis. The Canadian Cardiovascular Society recommends 150 minutes of cardiovascular exercise per week in spurts, at least 20 minutes at a time. That's your cardiovascular conditioning workout. So when you're getting on your Peloton or you're going walking with your dog, it's not just a gentle walk. It's getting your heart rate up to 75% of your maximum predicted heart rate. So you really are training your heart and your cardiovascular system. That has been shown to reduce blood pressure, of course, weight loss, because your caloric intake and use of that is important, reducing cholesterol levels. All those things are preventative of building up those plaque deposits in our arteries. So that's part of healthy lifestyle. And if you don't need medications for the rest of your life because you live a healthy lifestyle, so be it. That's fantastic. And many people are able to achieve that. Secondary prevention, however, is when you've had an event, you've had a heart attack or a stroke, and you're found to have plaque deposits in your arteries. And then it's a lot more aggressive. So we use medications much more there because we know that the incremental benefit on your cholesterol levels and also reduction in the narrowing of the arteries is much more effective. But we also have something called cardiac rehab, where people after having a heart attack will go to a supervised medical facility where we do a fitness test and then we prescribe exercise. And that prescription is to achieve a certain benefit after 6 months. We do a pre-stress test, meaning an exercise test, and a post-exercise test. And we give people basically a report card of how well they did over those 6 months at improving their cardiovascular fitness. We often use a sometimes difficult to access terminology called reduce mortality, but for what it essentially means is extend your life. So if you're able to do this program, a supervised cardiac rehab program, it extends your life. So to come back to your example of like, you know, driving down and seeing someone who's clearly unhealthy, yeah, I worry about their cardiovascular health. Now, everyone has cheat days, so to speak, and everything, and that's okay. But I think it's important for everyone to kind of live a balanced lifestyle that favors healthy foods, healthy proteins, low saturated fats, low salt intake, and regular exercise to try to prevent these what are essentially life-threatening conditions.
And so you've mentioned a few times in our interview vegan diet. And is that because a vegan diet in general is kind of low in saturated fats and all of these specific components that you just described? Or is a vegan diet actually as good as taking aspirin for your heart? And, you know, some of those things out there about red meat, is red meat good for your heart? Chocolate, wine, like, are there specific diets that you prescribe or in general, a low fat, normal kilocal diet? Like, what's the evidence on there?
Yeah. So the evidence is on what's called the Mediterranean diet, which is low in saturated fat, low in salt. What does that mean, practically speaking, for people who aren't necessarily counting calories every day? It means very low red meat consumption. So, you know, if you're going to eat red meat, it'd be about a 10-ounce steak once a week. And if possible, a filet mignon or something, you know, lean or lean ground beef or something like that. Certainly, you know, things like bacon and the fattier meats are not recommended. So also included in the Mediterranean diet, lots of fruits and vegetables. And if you are using fats, it's unsaturated fats and things like olive oil and natural fats like coconut oil and so on that are more easily digestible and don't convert to high risk lipids in your blood. And so those have been, you know, documented in trial and scientific study abound showing that they reduce the incidence of atherosclerosis and narrowing and plaque in the body and prevent heart attacks. So again, everyone cheats a little bit, but if you're able to maintain that kind of more balanced diet, then it certainly is a beneficial one. You know, you mentioned red wine, chocolate. So that's referring to certain anti-inflammatory components called resveratrols. Red wine, for example, has resveratrol. It's a potent antioxidant. And actually, you know, in experimental models, it's been shown to reduce cardiovascular risk. Not so much, though, in real life. So when you look at clinical trials, you know, drinking wine has not been shown to be effective at preventing heart disease. And you're probably familiar with the new guidelines in Ontario for alcohol consumption. Certainly the risk of multiple other non-cardiovascular problems with heavy alcohol ingestion certainly outweigh the potential incremental benefits of using a little bit of resveratrol in your red wine. So no one's recommending drinking wine to prevent heart disease. Chocolate, similarly, it's often laced with lots of fat and sugar and so on. So, you know, it's certainly not something used for benefit. I'm definitely not, as a scientist and as a healthcare provider and a traditional doctor, I guess you could say, I do have to certainly prioritize evidence-based medicine, but I also think there still is a world for a space for naturopathic medicine. I think there's a lot of things that we can ingest that have been shown to be quite beneficial. Now, do we ingest them in high enough proportions to be beneficial? Like an example is turmeric. Like turmeric, if you give it in a condensed form, has been shown to be beneficial at reducing atherosclerosis. But are we eating enough curry, really, to get that much turmeric? And what else is in that curry that is a problematic thing? So we have to be careful about assigning a lot of benefit to foods that we really like eating because there has to be, you know, there happens to be one ingredient in it that's beneficial when, quite frankly, there's maybe not a true benefit to eating that dish. But all that is work in progress. And, you know, we have dietitians and nutritionists that can help people work through those little aspects of their diet to try to make really well-educated decisions.
So me putting turmeric on my Cheetos is not doing what I think it is.
Sounds really tasty. What kind of Cheetos, though? Like the original?
Oh, the crunchy ones, the crunchy, spicy ones.
Yeah. I mean, you know, those were invented by astronauts. I mean, they must be fantastic for you.
Yeah. Well, that's what I do. I put a little bit of turmeric on them.
Yeah.
And eat them with a bit of chocolate and I protect my heart. But what I hear is the mainstay is a structured exercise program, the general tenets of a Mediterranean diet, and all of those things that kind of circulate in the orbit of heart health, you know, alcohol, how much, a little bit, a lot. Chocolate, turmeric, and some of these, you know, those mixing butter and turmeric into your coffee as an energy shot. Who knows? That's not something that's going to have as big an effect as the exercise programs and management of chronic diseases, but we might know something different in a few years. Now, as we've gone through this, the plumber analogy, I just love it. But there's one plumber analogy I wanted to clarify with you. As an interventional cardiologist, I was picturing this plumber in the house, and we've all had plumbers in the house working on the pipes, and the pipes often start underneath the sink. Is there an interventional cardiologist crack? Like, is that a thing? Like, because you guys are leaning over, putting these stents in and wearing scrubs, right? Is there an interventionalist crack, or is that not a thing?
Maybe I'll just leave that to the imagination of your listeners.
And the other thing is we've talked a lot about arteries and the cardiovascular system, by and large, when we talk about atherosclerosis, it's about arterial health. And arteries obviously bring oxygen to our tissues. Then that oxygen is absorbed and used by our tissues, and then it's brought back to the heart via our veins, right? And the veins bring it back up to the heart and the lungs to get more oxygen, and the cycle repeats. We haven't talked about veins much. Do you care about veins?
Veins are like the underappreciated little brother in the cardiovascular system. They tend to not develop atherosclerosis as much. It's interesting because an old friend of mine, Adam, is a vascular surgeon, and he is working on developing stents that are, you know, very specific to veins, because there are various other ailments that afflict veins more than arteries, and they still do cause narrowings. As you know, deep vein thrombosis, or DVTs, are blood clots that accumulate in veins when you're static, meaning you've been sitting for a long time. You know, the classic being if you've been on a long flight and you sit for 10 hours and you get off the flight and all of a sudden, you know, one of these blood clots lodges itself. So, you know, there are various conditions that do impact the veins, but they're not as life-threatening that something that affects the arteries, because as you mentioned, the arteries supply blood to tissues that are essential. And those tissues, if they're not getting that oxygen and the nutrients that come from blood, depending on the tissue and their metabolism, that is potentially a life-threatening problem. So when it's the heart, it's life-threatening. When it's the brain, it's even more so. You know, a stroke has to be addressed even more quickly than a heart attack does, because the brain's metabolic capacity is much higher. And so it needs immediate energy source. It can't live half an hour or an hour without oxygen supply and glucose supply. So, you know, all those things are a bit more impactful on the acute care, whereas, you know, certainly not ignoring venous system, that's more of a chronic health issue.
So I'll just say it as if I had one ticket to the Taylor Swift concert, I would invite my arteries, but not my veins. If I could only invite one, right? Like right now.
Well, I feel like your arteries would bring a plus one. So I think you'd be stuck with both.
And so heart v brain, right? You talked about the brain. If there's a blockage there, which is a stroke, you need to act a bit faster because of that higher metabolic rate. Which one's more important, heart or brain?
Oh, you're putting me on
I'm going
online
there.
Line and pitching me against neurologists. I'm going to plead the fifth on that one and say they're all important, but it's true. You know, if you have a stroke, it could be absolutely devastating because your brain isn't functioning properly. And depending on what part of your brain is affected, it could really, really shut down how your whole body works. Having said that, if your heart attack is big enough, you're just not going to supply anything to the rest of the body. So that's life-threatening. But you could say the same for lungs, the liver, kidneys, and so on. So all these organs are essential, and they all are intrinsically linked. The heart feeds the kidneys and the liver. If you have heart failure, it can affect the liver function and the kidney function. So, you know, all these things are intrinsically linked, and this is what you do, Mark, as an internist. You address everything, the interaction all these things do. I just fix one piece of the puzzle, and, you know, we leave it up to smarter people like you to fix the rest of the puzzle after we've fixed that aspect. So that's one of the more tricky and intrinsically complicated part of our bodies that make them so fascinating and also require multiple people to help out.
Well, listen, Mike, it was amazing having you in the studio today. I really felt that really helped me to get a clear understanding, a visual understanding of what you're doing and outlining in very clear terms what's happening when you have a heart attack, what an interventional cardiologist does, some of the strategies that people can employ to help maintain their health, and also your inclusion of all organs. And I feel the same way. Our bodies are many beautiful parts together. I value every part of my body except for my appendix. And I think everyone would feel the same way there.
Do you still have it, or did you get rid of it a long time ago?
I do, but I might just get some right lower quadrant pain at the worst possible time, like en route to the Taylor Swift concert. Then I have to get it out, and they take it out and they say, well, you didn't even need that anyway. So that's the one organ I don't really care about.
Hold on, when they say you didn't need it, do they mean the organ or the Taylor Swift concert?
No, the organ, the appendix. Oh, they take it out.
I don't think you needed the concert either.
Well, because if you had a heart attack, they don't take your heart out, right? You try to fix it.
Yeah.
But if you have appendicitis, which is an appendix attack, right? An acute inflammation or infection, the surgeons take it out and they say, well, you didn't even need this anyway. So
True. That's
the one organ I don't care about. And I just wanted to be clear about that.
Fair. Yeah.
But thanks for coming into the studio today, for making the time, for sharing your wisdom, and for sharing your experience and understanding of the heart and cardiovascular health in a language that everyone can understand. Thanks again to Dr. Michael Ward for joining us in the studio today.
Well, it was a very big pleasure, Mark. Thank you very much for hosting. And of course, I'm happy to answer any other questions if anyone has any. My professional email at Western University is where I usually get contact with anyone who has questions from the community. So happy to receive anything.
What a great conversation. It's moments like that that I am reminded as to why I went into medicine. The human body is such an amazing and fantastic thing. And I'm actually going to change my viewpoint of looking at the heart as a dumb muscle with plumbing and nerves. And looking at this beautiful relationship that the heart has with hormonal systems, with what we put into our bodies, and this is all coordinated by these wonderful activities at the level of the arteries, the capillaries, the nervous system, and that heart is so important for providing vital oxygen to all of our organs, making us feel a certain way. And having someone like Dr. Michael Ward in the studio is so invigorating. This man loves what he does. He's passionate about the science, and he's clearly able to translate that to everybody, not just with me in the conversation that we had today, but surely with all of the patients and collaborating healthcare professionals that he works with. And seeing someone who is so interested in and so passionate about his field of study and his field of work is definitely reassuring to me as one of millions of Canadians who may very well be one day requiring his services. And also reminds me of how fortunate I am to work in a career where there are so many other clinicians just like him who are passionate about their work, who are always looking to learn and to understand, and are always looking to translate some of the latest findings and research into the work that they do, and hopefully translate that knowledge to everybody out there in the population, their patients, to the listening audience, to friends at a cocktail party. Great information, great stuff, very eye-opening, and really made a very clear understanding of a very complex field, Dr. Michael Ward. A pleasure to have in the studio today. Now, we didn't get into it today in our conversation, but based on some of the research that he did when he described things like stem cells and implanting stem cells into hearts, I'd really like to have him back in here to talk about that and some of the applications for some of these futuristic type technologies to see if this is something that we're actually going to be living and experiencing, or maybe it doesn't even work at all. But I'm really interested in seeing what the future of regenerative medicine means for his field, and I'll definitely have to have him back. And I think I'm also going to have to invite some of the electricians as well, the electrophysiologists, to talk about the rhythm problems, why we see those defibrillator paddles in airports and on subways, at sporting events. Can anybody use them? Does it hurt? When do you think you need to turn them on? So a lot of interesting rhythm questions will certainly need to be addressed down the line. So I'll be sure that in addition to a plumber, I'll definitely have an electrician join us as well. And that concludes my reflections on today's episodes, whereby we had a very eloquent and wonderfully spoken Dr. Michael Ward, interventional cardiologist, join us today to simplify something that is actually incredibly complex. Wonderful to have him in the studio. Thanks again to my production team, audio engineer, and to the listening audience for tuning in today.
Thanks for listening to Ditch the Lab Coat with Dr. Bonta, the home of science-based skepticism. Tune in next Wednesday for another healthcare conversation. For more information, please visit labcoat.fm.